are flying high on Locked On Eagles, brought to you by LockedOnEagles.com, your daily source for the best Philadelphia Eagles news and analysis. I am your host, Michael Kist. You can follow my work at Inside the Pylon, Breaking Football, and Grandstand Sports Network. Follow me on Twitter at Michael J. Kist. That's K-I-S-T. As always, I am joined by the best co-host in the game, Mr. 7-Year Streak Without a Bad Day. He is Benjamin Solak of Bleeding Green Nation and NDT Scouting. You can follow him on Twitter at Benjamin Solak. That's S-O-L-A-K. Ben, how you doing, brother?
That was a heavy one, man. That was intense.
I took a lot out of me.
I mean, yeah, and shout out to those guys over there, Bleeding Green Nation Radio, doing a cool thing. They're starting a campaign for Brian Dawkins Hall of Fame after he was snubbed in 2017, so that's a wonderful thing. And so, yeah, shout out to John there for that one. But I'm doing well, Chief, having a good time. Regrettably, no crossover episode today. We weren't able to, co-align the schedules there with Marcus and Landon. We weren't able to make it happen, but that's okay. Mike and I know what we're talking about as far as film goes. We'll be able to still give you some flaming hot takes as far as Cowboys film goes.
And here's the deal. Some organizations are professional and got their stuff together. Cowboys not being one of them right now. So I understand that Marcus has his hands full with all 22 tape of the Cowboys trying to figure out what went wrong there. However, on the flip side of that, we had a blast figuring out what went on with the all 22 in this game. I usually don't get weekdays off, and I was so happy I was able to spend the day face down in some Cowboys Falcons tape. I had an absolute blast. What about you, man? Because it was a mess. It was a mess for the Cowboys. I was very excited.
Right. It's interesting because, and if you go back a couple weeks deeper into Cowboys film, you kind of get a better perspective on this in the sense that the offense didn't change too much in the wake of Ezekiel Elliott being out. I mean, they tried to accomplish the same things. You know, obviously McFadden wasn't too much involved in the backfield there, but Rod Smith, who they like a lot, and then Alf Moe, who, in my opinion, Alfred Morris should never have been cut by Washington. He was a fine starter, and he should be a starter somewhere else. So he's a fine running back, but he backs up Ezekiel Elliott there in Dallas, and you know they ran same sort of schemes, you know, nothing too much different. And then, you know, I think the run pass ratio is obviously a little bit skewed, though that has a lot to do with being behind for the majority of the game.
Yeah,
right. So really, it, you know, game plan wise, there wasn't too much of a change, which, you know, you can take that in a positive light because it means the Cowboys still believe they can execute their offense without Zeke. But then the negative light is, well, when there's no Teron Smith, you kind of have to change the game plan, which evidently that's not what happened. So while it's, you know, I feel like this was the Falcons film particularly was good film to get into individual performances. But as far as like a schematic perspective goes, just because it was so hard to execute because of Chaz Green's struggles on the outside with Adrian Claiborne, it was difficult to see, you know, how the team and how the execution worked as a whole.
I'll tell you what the loss of Ezekiel Elliott does do. And like you said, they really tried to accomplish a lot of the same things, but it really doesn't get talked about much. It limits what you do offensively from a schematic standpoint. And what I mean by that is Zeke can run zone. Zeke can run power. He is a viable option in the passing game, and he's very good in the screen game. When you take him out of the equation, you have three backs trying to fill each of those roles. Alfred Morris is a solid back, but his strength is primarily inside, outside zone running concepts. He does that very well. So when he's in there, the Falcons were pretty much keyed in on that, and there was only one drive where they had success with that. When you put Rod Smith in, it kind of tips their hand to the pass, and what you end up with is a playbook that is either half of what it was, or you end up with looks that don't provide enough variety because you're trying to pigeonhole these backs into these situations. So look, they had success with Morris on the ground, like I said, notably in the second half, where on one drive he had 45 yards on five carries, but they end up missing the field goal. They remain down two scores. Atlanta scores on the next drive, and now you're forced to abandon the run like we talked about, and that's how you end up with Dallas only possessing the ball for 27 minutes and 54 seconds when they usually average over 30 minutes a game. Dallas can't win that way. They need to be able to disguise that defense and grind clock, and if you're telling me that that offense is going to be successful in the least bit by passing the ball that much with a banged up Tyron Smith that may not play again, I just don't see that as a viable option.
Do you think really that Alf Moe, they can just pull off zone with him? Because I feel like he ran decently on power concepts. I was okay with it, at least. Maybe I'm just way higher on Alfred Morris than everybody else is, but I've always liked the way he plays.
I'm not using Alfred Morris in that way regularly. I'm playing to his strengths, and his strengths is way more towards the inside outside zone game. So I think it's lopsided there. I'm not saying he's bad at running power and things of that nature. It's just not what I'm going to have him do. You know what I mean?
No, I got you. And they ran in my viewing more power with Rod Smith than they did with Alfmo, for sure.
Right.
Yeah, I think when it comes to trying to diagnose the full extent of the loss of Ezekiel Elliott in such a game as this game, which was kind of just so chaotic on the offensive side of the ball for the Cowboys, I do agree that it probably does come down to it's easier to predict what might be coming your way based off of personnel and so on and so forth. I think you saw a significantly higher incidence of three tight end sets for the Cowboys than you had seen in previous games. They got Blake Jarwin, who Oklahoma State tight end, who I liked as a late round guy coming out. He's a rookie. Eagles tried to poach him earlier in the year off the practice squad of the Cowboys, promoted him to prevent Philadelphia from doing so. You know, Blake Jarwin got on the feet a little bit. He's a great blocker, and they ran well out of those three tight end sets, which is something you didn't so much see from with Ezekiel Elliott, because they could lighten up the box with Zeke and he could still be successful. I thought also one thing that was sorely missing from their game without Elliott, now that I'm thinking about it, was option style of plays, whether that's right. The speed option they like to work to the outside or just simple zone read. They weren't able to run those with much success, which in part goes to the fact that you've got a nice disciplined defense there, Dan Quinn's defense in Atlanta, but also the fact that I just think that Dax reads, you know, and his mesh point work isn't as good with those running backs you're bringing in, those second stringers, those third stringers, right? And that you're not as successful on those plays. You know, you need to be really quick in the backfield. I don't think that gelled necessarily. So you can say that I think in that regard, yeah, it's a lot more watered down. It's a lot more white bread of a rushing attack for sure.
Yeah, and the mesh point could be a sticky thing when you run those options, and I'm sure that Dak has a lot more trust in Elliott to take the handoff cleanly or not take the handoff when he feels Dak starting to pull it out. So that's a good point as well. They definitely weren't able to get that going, and like you said, some of that can be attributed to the fact that the Falcons have a fast to flow defense with fast linebackers that can, you know, leverage those points and not give up those big plays. Moving towards the passing game for the Cowboys real quick. I mean, I saw there were three plays at the end of the first half where Dak was running for his life, three consecutive plays. You know, you hit the pause button and you see that they're running ISO concepts with their wide receivers and no one is open and their offensive line is just getting shredded. And look, I know a lot of people said that they didn't give Chaz Green help in the game, but they did. They tried to, at least. It wasn't every single play. Maybe it wasn't as much as everyone expected it to be, but they chipped. They put tight ends over that side, so on and so forth. So I thought they did try to mask that. And then even with Bell in it later on, it didn't work out. How does this offense move on from this, learn from this? And if Smith isn't back for them, what do they have to do to protect their quarterback and not get him killed?
So first thing I think is Chaz Green will play better next week, because it's just physically impossible to play worse than the performance he put out against Atlanta. And I'm sorry, Mr. Green, if you're listening to this, you're very big and you're very scary, but that was really bad, man. Right. So that, I think, you know, you're not going to see him give up another 6-sack performance. So there's that, number one. Number two, I think that I anticipate seeing a lot more rollout options and a lot more sprint options for Dak Prescott. Dak Prescott is a right-handed quarterback, so if you get him moving to his right, he can be more successful in that regard, and you're moving him then away from that problematic left tackle position. Of course, then you're asking a lot from Lyle Collins as a right tackle, and Lyle's been up and down all year, you know, and I don't foresee one of his up games being against the Philadelphia Eagle defense, you know what I'm saying? The next thing I would anticipate, and this is something that really surprised me, Jimmy Kemsky, a friend of the Locked On Eagles podcast, tweeted out this morning, you know, doing his Cowboys research, very surprising to him, Cole Beasley, who's the Cowboys' excellent slot wide receiver, is only sixth on the team in receiving yards with 188. That's you know, he's never had more than 33 per game, according to Kemsky's tweet. That really surprises me. Cole Beasley's a dangerous weapon, and he's a very, very difficult cover there in the slot. He can do a lot of things, you know, even further down the field with his ability to manipulate routes, and he has a lot of burst, a lot of quickness. He separates very well. It surprises me that he is not that featured in this passing attack. If I'm looking to get the ball out quickly, that's the guy who I'd like to attack, right? I'd like to run my offense a little bit through Cole Beasley. So if I'm the offensive coordinator there, if I'm Scott Linehan, I'm doing a couple things. I'm going to roll out Dak a lot more. I'm going to sprint out Dak a lot more. And I should clarify, when I say, you know, roll out and sprint out, two different concepts. A rollout concept usually involves a play action fake, where I'm at play action to the left side of the offense and then roll out to the right side. And the offensive line action in that regard is usually to the left with the play action. A sprint out sort of an action is where the quarterback receives the snap, usually without a play action, and just moves one direction immediately, and the offensive line moves that way with him. So that's the distinction between sprint out and rollout actions. That's what I would anticipate seeing. And then I would get the ball out of Dak's hands a whole heck of a lot quicker. And if I'm doing so, I'm expecting to see a lot more Cole Beasley involved. And then you're obviously going to get Dez on some big boy slants, you know, where he just bodies a corner, gets him out of the way, 8 yard pickup, so on and so forth.
Yeah, they have to limit that time to throw however they can do it. And some of those throws look like some of those plays look like sprint out plays. And it wasn't even designed. It was just Dak was abandoning the pocket that quickly. And he had to. I mean, he had to. And he got away with a couple bad throws, too. But if you want to, like we said before, if you want to put this game on Dak Prescott, you are mistaken. No quarterback can thrive in that type of situation. He was under fire constantly. All right, so let's move over to the defensive side of the ball. One thing that I noticed early, Anthony Brown made a play early, the cornerback for them, that led to an interception. But after that, man, he really, really struggled, as seems can be said for the rest of the secondary. There were a couple of times where Brown was expecting help, but the Falcons really attacked their zones with some excellent spacing concepts off condensed splits. They used bunch formations that confused the Cowboys secondary that is really still trying to figure each other out. Yeah. Brown has given up 5 touchdowns on the year, and it would have been 6 if he didn't hold Taylor Gabriel in the red zone when Gabriel opened him up. So it was a tough day for him. And then you look at what the Falcons did off play action, up 17-7 in the red zone. They run the same play action concept from different formations on back-to-back plays to Austin Hooper, where they started Hooper on the left side of the formation. They leaked him out to the right flats, and he was absolutely uncovered both times. The first one looked like linebacker Jalen Smith, who had a bad game. He got lost in space or caught up in the trash or whatever, but he wasn't in the same area code. And then on the next one, Byron Jones just flat out left the country if he was supposed to be covering that. So what did you see from this secondary when you watched the All-22?
Yeah, so I thought that, like you, Anthony Brown had a very poor game. And I want to talk about Anthony Brown for a little bit because this is an issue that I think a lot of teams make and even a lot of fans make. Anthony Brown was a 6th-round rookie in 2016. He was brought in as a depth piece. He did well in training camp, and he was one of their backup corners. Injuries forced the start for Brown in the season. He played well. For a 6th-round player to play well his rookie season, it's very, very difficult to rely upon him as a piece coming into his second season. I think there's just an anticipated sophomore slump. You have to expect that a 6th-round player is going to regress in that regard. Right now, oftentimes there are different storylines. You know, you don't want to call it just based off of draft position, because take a guy like Jalen Mills, for example, where Mills was drafted in the 7th round, but he always was a greater talent than that. It was injury, and it was, you know, character history or whatever. So, you know, there's storylines to be had, but Anthony Brown was a guy who simply outplayed the talent level at which he was drafted. It was not anticipated he would be that good of a player, right? And so you expect a regression the same way we talked about, you know, expecting a Dak regression. It's a 4th-round player who's playing like beyond his talent. While Dak has continued to be fine, you know, relying on Anthony Brown right now is foolish. You know, he's their starter in their base packages over Jordan Lewis, and he's not playing as well as Jordan Lewis. The only reason he's still starting is because there's a flawed belief that because he flashed in his rookie season, he has some sort of talent that he doesn't. Jordan Lewis is more talented, right, period, and he should be playing. So I agree. I thought that Byron Jones, who makes a lot of splash plays, is always a spotty-ish player for me. He just doesn't have natural instincts, and I worry about that as a safety, you know, overhang hybrid. You want that guy to be really true to his keys. He's playing different positions, and that's never been Byron Jones for me. Brown played poorly. I thought Orlando Scandrick had a nice game, but Orlando Scandrick usually just kind of was like a solid player. And then Jordan Lewis, I thought, played great. And in limited snaps and limited reps, and I expect him to get more moving forward if Dallas is serious about getting some help there for their secondary.
Who would you say was the best person on the field for Dallas's defense in that game?
DeMarcus Lawrence every time he plays, right? I thought DeMarcus Lawrence played well. I like what I see out of David Irving as well, that other defensive lineman they have, and they move him inside and outside. I think he's pretty good. I thought that Sean Lee obviously played very well, as he usually does before he went out with injury, and then I thought Anthony Hitchens, who's another linebacker they have there, played well in his stead. Jalen Smith, I agree, though, just really, it sucks for Jalen Smith. I mean, because you're gone from football for so long, and then once you're back, the speed of the game is ridiculous compared to the speed that you just left. I mean, his mind isn't sharp, you know, his body isn't sharp. It's heartbreaking to watch him play so far below his talent level. It really is.
I agree. And when there are plays where both Anthony Hitchens and Jalen Smith are crashing the same gap, and Hitchens had been playing so well up to that point, you got to put it on Jalen. He was miserable in run fits, bad in pass coverage, just seems lost out there, and it's a shame because, you know, I'm a Notre Dame fan as well, and I'm rooting for the guy, and you would root for the guy anyway. I mean, you don't want to see anybody go down with an injury like that and, you know, screw up their entire history. It's a miracle that he made it back to begin with. So definitely, I would agree that Hitchens had a great game. DeMarcus Lawrence, man, he has 46 pressures on the season.
He's an animal.
That is, yeah.
He's going to make so animal. Much money if when he hits the market. Firstly, if Dallas doesn't franchise tag him, that's just stupid. That's right. So dumb. Even if they intend on signing him long term, I think they should franchise tag him because I think that he won't be able to put together as good of a season as he just did. So I think that I would wait. But then again, probably the market resets later. Okay, never mind. Just sign. I would extend him right now. The stuff that he's very nuanced too. Like he's always been like an athlete rusher, but some of the stuff that he's doing as far as stringing together pass rush moves is like scary good.
Yeah. So what we're gonna do is we're gonna do more of a Eagles versus Cowboys look, you know, offense, running offense first, run defense, passing offense first, pass defense, and then flip it on Friday. So that was our little look into the Cowboys All 22 tape. But what we're going to do now is move on to Game Time Decisions.
Theme music.
So if you haven't heard Game Time Decisions before, basically me and Ben bounce questions off of each other. We have not discussed the questions before the show. In fact, I was making up my questions as we were recording just now. So every answer is off the cuff. It could be football, it could be personal hygiene, it could be history, or whatever the case is. So Ben, man, hit me with the first one.
All right, so I did a spot on Draft Dudes, which is the NDT scouting podcast with Kyle Krabs and Joe Marino. And Joe, without knowing that we do Game Time Decisions, he said he was going to hit me with a six-pack of questions, and he kind of just dropped a couple, which was cool. It was fun. So I was prepared for it, which was nice. And this was one that he gave me, and I want to send it right back to you. Right now, you've got to draft a quarterback in this upcoming class. Who is it and why?
Oh, wow. Right now, without knowing the medical on Josh Rosen's shoulder, who I really like Rosen. Mm-hmm. I think he's the top quarterback in this class. I don't know the off-field stuff. So right now, just gut instinct, I'm going Baker Mayfield. The guy's a baller. I think he's got a strong enough arm. I don't care about the height. It's not too short to where it's a big-time issue. And I see tall quarterbacks get, you know, passes batted down at the line all the time. Also, the swag that he has is off the charts. Like, he's QB swag one, no matter what. And it's not in it like an annoying way, like a Johnny Manziel. Like, his teammates respond to him. He's not some, you know, well, he's a bit of an animal. I call him Baker Bucephalus Mayfield after Alexander the Great's wild horse that only he was able to tame and bring into battle and everything like that, because, you know, he seems like a wild dude. You know what I mean? But yeah, I'm going Baker.
I appreciate the explanation there, because I've always wondered what Bucephalus is whenever you tweet out a Mayfield clip.
Yeah, every time, man. Every time. Okay. So I hit you with one. Earlier in the season, you tweeted out that Adam Thielen is a top 15 wide receiver.
Yes! I wish, listeners, you could see me celebrating right now.
I just put out a four-play thread of Adam Thielen's performance against the Washington Redskins, where he torched for 8 and 166 and a touch. Explain to the gentle listeners why Adam Thielen is, in fact, a top 15 wide receiver.
I'll take you further than that. I think Adam Thielen is right now a top 15 wide receiver in the league, absolutely. And I've been tweeting stuff out like this since like April, all right? Like, this is one of my takes that's landing, and I'm never going to let you all forget it. But I'll tell you right now, I don't think you could name three wide receivers in the league playing better football than Adam Thielen right now, right? And again, like, you know, we talk about regressions and normalizing a lot. I don't think he's a top five wide receiver. I think he's having, like, you know, a breakout huge season. He needs to do it more consistently to get that title. But right now, I think maybe Antonio Brown.
Antonio Brown and Julio Jones are the only two that have more yards route per run than Adam Thielen right now.
I mean, yeah, so AB and Julio, but I think that Thielen, you know, is up there. Thielen also, by the way, is a better wide receiver than Stephon Diggs, and I've been saying that for a while as well. I know Diggs is the...
And Diggs is awesome.
Yeah, exactly. I know he's the presumptive one there, but it's Adam Thielen. Adam Thielen is that exact blend of really, really, really nuanced, right, in the sense that he just understands very clearly when he plays what his role is and how to best execute it, right? And things we don't talk about enough when it comes to wide receivers is generating throwing windows, in the sense that Adam Thielen, whether he's running, you know, a 1 yard slant or a 15-yard post corner post, right? Yeah. Like he, you can tell that before the snap, he knows where he thinks these corners, where he thinks those safeties are going. You can tell where he knows that, all right, I need to do this, 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 and this to cross face and to generate a window. I don't think anybody generates throwing windows better than Adam Thielen. And we talk about separating. Separating is one thing. Adam Thielen, it's more than separating. It's getting open, but it's providing that space for the quarterback to get you the football, right? To giving him that throwing lane, you know, in the sense that you can separate on like a 12-yard comeback, but if you don't appropriately run the stem of that route, you're going to be too close to the sideline for the quarterback to get the ball there, right? Thielen never makes that mistake. He never makes it. And so that alone makes him more valuable than you think he is. It's the perfect blend of that nuance with an athletic profile that, you know, forgive me, it's sneaky. It's underrated, right? Like we always say, like, oh, white people, you got sneaky athlete. Adam Thielen's got a huge catch radius. Adam Thielen has incredible hands away from his body. Adam Thielen has excellent contested catch ability. Adam Thielen is one of the most elusive, quick twitch wide receivers in this league, and we don't notice it. We simply don't. Whether it's because of a lack of volume or because Stephon Diggs is there or because, you know, there's been a carousel of far too cautious quarterbacks in Minnesota for years, Thielen is dynamic. He's explosive. He's powerful, and he's strong. And I remember when I was going through his tape, he was a restricted free agent. I wanted the Eagles to push at him. I was going through his tape. I was like, what is that? Who is this dude? Why is he not getting more volume? I'm so happy about the Adam Thielen resurgence, not actual resurgence. It's been fantastic.
Yeah. So at Michael J. Kist, follow me on Twitter and check out my Adam Thielen thread. Ben, I don't know if you've even seen that thread yet that I just put out. Mm-hmm. You hit on all the points I just hit on. His ability to find voids and defenses, his ability at the break point to sink and separate and make himself available in those. It's excellent. Tracking the ball, all that stuff. He's excellent. Okay, Ben, hit me with the next one.
No, I got to finish the plug. If you just search on Twitter, Solak, my last name, and then Thielen, you'll just see all of it. Or hashtag Adam Thielen as a top 15 wide receiver, which I know is a very long hashtag. I've been tweeting under it for like 2 months. I love it. All right, my next one for you in honor of Rivalry Week. Did Dez catch it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I definitely think he caught it. I think it was a football move. I'm not going to put the homer blinders on because if an Eagle were to do that and get screwed on a call like that, I'd be furious. He catches it. He comes down. He makes a move to reach out for the end zone. That, to me, is a football move. And I know you need to control it through the ground and all that crap. That's a catch. If I had done that and they called it, no. That's a catch.
I'll never forget what was happening because I was driving to a buddy's house while that was happening. So it was like a birthday party or something or whatever. And I heard the play over like the radio. And I got to his house, I parked the car, I left the car running, and I sprinted inside of his house without like announcing I was there. Just opened the door because I knew the game would be on. And I go and I see it, and I said, that is a catch, but by rule, it's not a catch. And so it should not be called a catch, even though it clearly is a catch, right? We know it's a catch. And it's been fun because, you know, tomorrow we'll release the pod on 44-6. Going through that game film, there are so many plays that would be called differently just 10 years later because all the rules have changed. But anyway, yeah, that's my question for you.
Next one up is I heard you say this earlier. Is it roots or routes?
I mean, whatever I'm feeling in the moment. I don't know. I don't think about it that much. Let me think. I mean, yeah.
Because you say roots a lot. Like, I'm really starting to notice it lately, but I feel like it's a new thing. Like, are you listening to more Pro Football Focus podcasts?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Like, I'm perfectly fine with both pronunciations, and I guess whichever one happens. I'm just subject to the whimsy of the world, man.
I think it's actually correct. I think roots is actually correct, but I don't know.
I've always said routes. I'm 100% going to be super self-conscious about it now moving forward. Like every time we talk about wide receivers, I'm being in my head like, all right, pick one and be consistent. I don't know. All right. Here's my question for you. We're both in sports media. You know, we're both writers and everything like that. How do you feel in general about the whole move to video concept, right? Like a lot of, you know, background for listeners who don't necessarily know, a lot of publications are really pushing, you know, towards a move to video sort of thing where that's the main medium they want to produce their content in, and it's led to like layoffs of writers and stuff. What are your thoughts?
I think podcasting is a great medium to reach people. I wouldn't watch nearly as much video as I would read articles, but I might be a unique breed when it comes to that because I read a lot anyway in my spare time, whether it be literature or about football. For the general public, I mean, you're sitting at your desk and you got a video rather than reading. I don't know, man. Like, if you're doing it for it's an advantage for me because I have experience in video. I have experience in those things, so I don't mind it. As far as other people go, it's a hard transition to be able to do that at a high level. I would rather see writers stick around.
No, I agree with that 100%. I feel like, yeah, like, you know, as somebody who loves to write, like, I enjoy producing written content. I understand the value of video. I think both have their place, are incredibly valuable and everything like that. I wonder, though, about a wide sweeping move to video. It makes me feel as if there'll be a void left behind. But we'll kind of see what happens. You know, it's going to be over years sort of thing.
Hopefully that void is podcasting. All right. You can take one movie with you to a desert island.
Remember the Titans.
What is that movie? Jeez.
Yeah. No. I mean, there's... I own Remember the Titans on DVD, which is a very old sentence for somebody who's 20 years old, right? Like, I don't own movies on DVD. I watch Remember the Titans at least once a year. Like, I have a reminder in my Google Calendar that, like, you know, it'll come up in, like, September and be like, dude, like, you haven't watched Remember the Titans yet this summer. Like, get it done. Mm. I'm like, don't worry. I've already done it somehow. No, I could probably quote to you most of the major scenes in that movie. It's one of the most, you know, just this... Remember the Titans is a fantastic film.
Yeah, nice. All right, you got one more for
me? Yeah, I got one more for you. Today, I burned like an hour and a half unnecessarily because I just got, like, I was scrolling through Twitter and The Ringer was hosting a superhero draft, right? Which was awesome. I love superheroes, for those who don't know. And it was four people and they had a list of all these superheroes and there were five categories, right? It was, you know, villain and cosmic powers, born with powers, acquired powers, and non-powered. And, like, you know, they did this whole draft and everything. It was awesome. I loved it. I'm a nerd. Whatever. So here's my question to you. Favorite superhero of all time. Who is it?
Iron Man.
You suck.
It's Iron Man. Why?
Because Iron Man sucks.
How does he suck?
Iron Man is a person with, like, a battery in his chest who wears a suit who does all the work for him.
Yeah, but Iron Man is also an alcoholic, womanizing, super genius.
Oh, I mean, I didn't think about it like that. Right. You're right. That's who I should be idolizing. Good point, Mike.
That's right up my alley. I can relate to that.
See, I guess, like, see, you framing it that way makes sense, though, now, because my favorite superhero is Captain America, and it's for, like, all of the exact opposite reasons, right? It's because he's, like, super, like, principled and, like, moral and value and stuff. That's awesome.
But this is why this podcast works, Ben, is because I am Iron Man and you are Captain America. Right?
When do we get to our Civil War movie where we end up having a massive row and, like...
I feel like we have a Civil War before, during, and after every show. It's just very subtle and under the water, you know what I mean?
A perpetual Civil War that just continues day after day. It's Groundhog Day. That's two movie references now that we've dropped. Good work.
All right, Ben, what do we got going on for the rest of the week for the gentle, gentle listeners?
Right, so no crossover pod. Looks like it'll be happening this week. Dang shame, of course. But don't worry, tomorrow is rivalry weekend, 44-6, talking about that fantastic 2008 game between the Eagles and the Cowboys. If you guys didn't listen last Thursday, last week, Mike dropped the championship game. 1980, was it, Mike?
1980. NFC championship game. Incredible. Dallas Cowboys and Philadelphia Eagles.
Yeah, I know. Incredible production. Mike put a ton of work into it. I did nothing. He is the man. Go listen to that. It's so much fun. So that'll be dropping on Thursday, and then we'll be back live on Friday, finishing up the preview for Cowboys and the Eagles. Like Mike said, taking a more Eagles-centric instead of a Cowboy-centric focus, as we did on this pod.
You got to keep it locked on here on Locked On Eagles. Fly, Eagles, fly.
Caw-caw! I did a big one.